From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, on day 31 of the national strike, GM and the UAW reach a tentative contract agreement.
Essentially, nobody was unscathed by this. It hurt both sides.
A disappointing harvest for Michigan corn and soybeans thanks to our very rainy spring.
It was so wet that farmers couldn't get out into the fields. They couldn't get things planted, so therefore, you know, we're going to see production down, and then also what they did get planted was planted later than normal.
The Michigan-born TV critic for the New York Times on how Donald Trump rode reality television right into the White House.
He set out to court the cameras, to court the media, and create a persona, a character of himself that he then leveraged into other areas of accomplishment.
Those stories and more for you today on Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. On today's program, we'll talk with a Michigan-born author who's now the chief TV critic for the New York Times. His new book explores President Donald Trump's very close relationship with television. But first, it took 31 days of a national strike, but the UAW and General Motors have reached a tentative contract agreement. Workers on the picket line in Flint had this reaction.
My name is Marlo Washington, and I'm a material driver. I'm a hollow driver here. Oh, that's good news. That's good news. Most of the our members are employees of the members of the union. Most of us are ready to come back to work. But you know, only under the conditions of a fair agreement.
My name is Marsha Easley. Well, job security is very important, as far as hiring, getting new hirees in, because for the next generation, that's very important, especially for all of us old-timers who are ready to get out here. That's very important. You know, it's different now. So many contract workers, instead of just hire them, let's hire them. And of course, we all want part of that profit sharing, because, wow, why should somebody get billions and let's not get a fair share of it?
Mike Martinez has been covering this strike for the Automotive News, and he is here with us now. Mike, what do we know, if anything, about this tentative agreement?
Well, we don't have any details yet. However, the union said in a statement today that it secured major wins for its members, being a little vague there. But as far as we know from the last proposal that GM put forward, we were able to confirm that those plans included $7.7 billion in U.S. investment and an additional $1.3 billion for a deal in Lordstown to create battery cell manufacturing that would be slightly separate from the rest of the things. Reuters has also reported a $9,000 ratification bonus for rank and file, as well as a $3,000 ratification bonus for temporary employees, and then raises in the second and fourth year of the contract of 3%, and then a number of lump sum payments in the other years of that deal as well.
We'll be watching to see what happened on healthcare, because we know that was a big issue, but I know that they stay pretty tight-lipped at this phase, don't they?
Exactly. What they're doing right now is they're flying in members of the UAW GM National Council, so essentially local union hall presidents and other high-ranking officials from all over the country are coming into Detroit, and they will meet Thursday morning, and they'll present the details to them then, and they are hoping that they won't leak out before then, because they feel their members deserve the right to know first.
So if the council approves it, then what, the deal goes to the workers for ratification?
Exactly. The council needs to agree to it, which the union leadership and GM leadership will strongly suggest that they do. And if they do, which is pretty likely, it will then go to the rank and file for ratification votes that typically take place over the course of a week to 2 weeks.
So this isn't right away. And just thinking in history for a little context, has it happened in the past where, you know, the union leadership says, hey, everybody, here's our tentative contract agreement, and the workers reject it?
Sure. It happened in recent history in 2015. Fiat Chrysler was the target company in those negotiations, and workers voted down their first tentative agreement, mostly because it did not contain a path to eliminate the two tiers of workers that they have complained for years about. Hmm. So they went back to the drawing board. They developed this 8-year growing period that currently exists, and they brought that forward to the members, and they ratified the second tentative agreement.
So, yes, it's certainly within their rights to be able to say, do better. And so with that in mind, how does this morning's tentative agreement affect the picket lines?
Well, nothing to say on that just yet. The members are still out there. They are still on strike. Terry Dittus, the GM UAW vice president, told them to continue picketing, and they will make a decision after tomorrow's meeting. The UAW GM National Council has asked for the right to decide when the strike ends. So they will either decide tomorrow to end it immediately, which is what happened in 2007 during the last strike. They announced a tentative deal and ended the strike immediately. Or they may decide to keep workers on the picket lines through the ratification process.
So that will be determined. Well, here we know that General Motors has been losing, one estimate I saw was $450 million a week. At the same time, UAW leaders are under the cloud of this ongoing federal corruption investigation. Which side was under more pressure to get this done, do you think?
That's a very good question. And essentially, nobody was unscathed by this. It hurt both sides. Now, as you mentioned, that corruption probe, now we're really going to see whether or not that has any impact on the union, because the members will have to take a look at this proposal and say, was this bargained in good faith? We have a president who has been implicated reportedly in these corruption charges. We have a member of the executive board who has been placed on leave because he was arrested on corruption charges. So did they really negotiate this in our best interest? They'll have to decide that. GM obviously was under tremendous pressure because not only were GM workers affected, but dealerships were affected, suppliers were affected. There were many, many smaller suppliers that have had to lay off hundreds and thousands of workers. A couple reports last week that there were a few suppliers in the Michigan area who said they may close. They may lose their business if the strike drags on. So it's not just impacting the union workers in the plants. It has ripple effects that are affecting the entire community here.
Meantime, there has been kind of low-key bargaining already happening at Ford, yes?
Both at Ford and FCA. So these things sort of happen simultaneously. GM was the target company. They will set the pattern for what happens at Ford at FCA. But while talks have been going on, Ford and FCA have been hammering out the details on the less contentious stuff. There's a number of subcommittees that deal with things like health and safety, quality, sourcing, and all those smaller groups are reaching agreements on their specific parts of the contract, but they will have to contend with the larger economic issues, which is honestly what always holds things up.
Mike Martinez, Automotive News. As always, Mike, we appreciate your time and thank you so much.
Thank you.
Michigan's wet, rainy spring is now taking its toll as farmers head to their fields in search of a harvest. The USDA October crop report predicts Michigan will see some of the lowest crop production for corn and soybeans in more than a decade. Let's see what this all means as we say hello to Teresa Sisson, who's a field crops specialist for the Michigan Farm Bureau. So, Teresa, what's in the October forecast? Start with corn production.
So from what USDA is predicting, they're looking at Michigan corn production being down roughly 9% from where we were at last year. Yields, they're actually estimating to be up a little bit, but because we had so few acres planted, that's why we're going to see our production levels probably be down.
And we're talking how long has it been since we had this level of corn production?
Yep. So corn production, the last time we saw production this low would have been 2004.
Oh boy. And what about soybeans?
So for soybeans, that's kind of the bigger story. We're looking at production potentially being down 30%.
And that would be the lowest, again, in more than a decade?
Yes, that's the lowest since 2008.
So why is soybean production so much worse than corn?
A lot of it just had to do with the weather and when people could get planted. They were trying to get corn planted, and then it just got to the point where they couldn't really get anything planted. And also some of it had to do with the way their crop insurance worked. For some of them, it was a little bit better for them to maybe plant corn but not plant soybeans. And it just kind of depends on where they were at in the state and how late they got into the season that unfortunately they just were not able to get acres of soybeans planted.
So this is, we can all kind of dump this in the lap of weather with that wet, rainy May and June we had?
Yes, this has to do predominantly with that. It was so wet that farmers couldn't get out into the fields. They couldn't get things planted. So therefore, you know, we're going to see production down. And then also what they did get planted was planted later than normal. So when you're planting a crop later, you're typically going to see lower yields too. So also adding to the decline in production.
All right. So what does this mean for Michigan's farmers, especially the ones who are coping with the problems posed by the trade tensions with China? Because soybean farmers are really caught in the middle of that, aren't they?
They are. It's tough to say exactly the impact. It's going to depend more farmer to farmer what it's going to be. It'll definitely be a hit to their bottom lines. It's going to affect the farm economy as a whole, just because you're seeing such a great decline, and farmers were already struggling. So we don't know the final impact. Obviously, we're especially just getting into the start of harvest, but we do know there's going to be a pretty large impact from this year.
And I guess, is it too early to project an impact on the state's overall economy?
It is too early. I think the ones that will probably see it first are some of those smaller, more rural towns that really depend on farmers to come in and, you know, buy food at the local diner, use the tire shop, things like that. I think those are the communities that will probably be impacted first, just because the farmers are not going to be able to come in and make some of those extra purchases they maybe had made in the past.
Teresa, what about the outlook for other crops, you know, sugar beets or fruit? What are we thinking?
So really, when it comes to field crops, they're all down across the state. Dry beans, so your black beans, navy beans, things like that. We're looking at production down 15%. And sugar beets, they're looking at a roughly 6 to 7% decline in production for this year.
What could the weather be doing now that could help improve things for the crops that still have to be, they're in there? I mean, what's the best case scenario and the worst case scenario with the weather?
The worst case scenario would be a killing freeze. Right now, because we have a lot of crops that, because they were planted late, they're not mature yet. So we need some more heat units. If we could get some warmer weather, some sunny days, and some wind to help dry out from the rain we have had, that would kind of be the best case scenario. So crops could mature and farmers could get out there and harvest before we have a killing freeze.
Okay. And I know I thought I saw frost on the roof, you know, one morning this week. We've had some pretty chilly evenings.
We have had some chilly days. We've had some frost, which will damage the crops a little bit, but the killing freeze would be if we get below 28 degrees, it'll kill the plants completely. So if we can keep it above that and avoid as much frost as possible, that would be good for these farmers.
Teresa Sissung, who is a field crop specialist for the Michigan Farm Bureau. Teresa, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Coming up, in the early years of the Great Depression, American-born children of Mexican parents were sent from Michigan to Mexico. I'll look at the history of Mexican repatriation and people from Michigan coming up next, right here on Stateside. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. It is Wednesday, and you know that means it's time to talk our state's history. Immigration issues in this country are certainly a daily news headline. The debate over amnesty, the border wall, the treatment of detained individuals, it certainly sparked sharp campaign rhetoric for Republicans and Democrats. Many assume America is the ultimate immigrant destination, but we wondered if there was ever a time when people living in this country, in the U.S., thought they could find a better life somewhere else. Well, let's talk about one such example and its connection to Michigan as we welcome Dr. Delia Fernandez, who is professor of history at Michigan State University. Delia, welcome back.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Good to have you here. So can you give us an example of people in Michigan who looked to find a better place elsewhere?
Yes. And actually, this is a very personal example for me. My grandmother was actually born in Saginaw. She was raised in Saginaw. She's of Mexican-American descent. Her parents were born in Mexico. So she grew up on the fields. Her family was recruited from Texas to work in Saginaw. And when she was a teenager, really right at the beginning of World War II, she tried to get on a truck with migrant workers who were headed to the border. She brought her sister along, and her logic was that there had to be something better than this, that Mexico was going to be somehow better for her as a Mexican-American teenage girl living in rural Michigan. They did not get very far. Their parents found out about it. But I think that's really emblematic of the ways that Mexican, especially young people, were thinking about where they fit in Michigan at this time. That if it wasn't here for them, if they didn't feel like they belonged here, then perhaps Mexico would be this place that was so much more welcoming to them.
Almost a sense of, I'm going back to my roots.
Yes, even though she was born and raised in Saginaw.
Exactly. Living with a foot in either side of the border, emotionally speaking.
Yes.
And there was actually a committee formed about this?
Yes. So in the 1930s, the United States undertook a repatriation campaign. So this happened at a local level, at a state level, at a national level. And repatriation means to go back, to send something back to one's country of origin. So in this case, it was people. At this time, at the national level, the United States was interested in taking on deportation campaigns for people who were here without documentation, but also at a local level, as local as your welfare office. Of course, the welfare office was responsible for trying to take care of people during the Depression, and we saw that those welfare officials were trying to send people back to Mexico, trying to convince them, in some ways coercing them. And then we also saw this backed up through state militias, National Guard, different levels of our military apparatus.
Well, it is interesting to think that people from Mexico were invited in before the Depression when they were needed to fill jobs. And then when the Depression happened and jobs became scarce, it's like, let's push them back across the border. And I think ultimately, some 1.8 million people were deported to Mexico, and about 60% of them were actually American citizens.
Yes, they were Mexican-American. They were children and grandchildren of Mexican nationals. So the committee that was formed at this time was in Mexico. They were Mexican nationals, Mexican citizens, many of them more wealthy during or had a little bit more money during the Depression. And they hoped to raise money to help those Mexicans who were returning to Mexico. And their hope was that they could provide them with land, they could provide them with farming equipment and materials so that the transition wouldn't be as hard. And this was going to be a point of pride for Mexican nationals at the time to say that they could take care of their own. And if they weren't wanted in the United States, then they could always come home.
When I think of what we're talking about in the 1930s, how many people were kind of, doing what your grandmother ultimately did when she was young, thinking, you know what, I think things will be better. I want to go there.
I don't think there were that many, to be honest. I think when it came down to this decision to leave, it wasn't exactly this decision that people were making freely and of their own will. There were so many factors that were coercing them to leave that it's really hard to judge. For example, like my grandmother, the inhospitable environment in Saginaw was something that was pushing her towards this decision. And then to add these very national attitude towards Mexicans at the time was very negative. They were the scapegoat for the Depression. People had said it was Mexicans who were causing this. So for those people who were thinking it was going to be better, it wasn't necessarily really truly what they imagined.
So what type of life awaited Michiganders who moved back to Mexico?
Well, the program of the repatriation committee that they had put together was really well-intentioned. But what they found was that the land that they were giving to the repatriated folks was not desirable land. It was not very fertile land. And honestly, if it had been, it would have been taken by Mexicans who were already there. The Depression was a global phenomenon. So Mexico was also in a depression. So the land and this promise of, economic stability, that was never really fulfilled. And for many people, especially the young people, they found isolation. Because they had grown up in the United States, some of them didn't even speak Spanish or had such a cultural distance between themselves and Mexico that when they got there, they were very lonely, very isolated. And then for those Mexican Americans who were repatriated with their families or who went to Mexico for the first time with their families, some of them were unable to gather their documentation because they were forced to leave. So they were essentially stuck in Mexico. They could not return to the United States even after the Depression because they didn't have the documentation to prove that they were American citizens.
What has changed for Mexican Americans in Michigan since 1933, and what hasn't?
Well, I think that there's, the negative sentiment towards Mexicans, unfortunately, is still here in many cases. And we can see that by our own local headlines. But I think that there has been more, as much as the negative sentiment is there, there have been more people who are more welcoming. And a lot of this, I think, is due to the credit of Mexicans themselves who have committed to staying in Michigan and making it a welcoming place. The actions that they undertook, for example, making churches in Michigan, joining or forming sports leagues, sending their kids to local schools, holding dances, making stores that have the cultural products that they're interested in. All of these are examples of placemaking or making a place suitable to your cultural needs. They've done an excellent job at making Michigan home. And other people, not Mexicans, who are non-Mexican, I think have learned to embrace them as well.
Certainly, as we think of what happened 80 years ago, the echoes are very, very loud today, aren't they?
Very loud, especially when we consider families who are mixed status families, who have some folks who are citizens and some are non-citizens. And when they're thinking about returning back to their country of origin, what do we do with those families and those young people in particular?
Something to think about as we mark Hispanic Heritage Month. Dr. Delia Fernandez, Professor of History at Michigan State University, we want to thank you for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. It is Gershwin performed in a fresh new way. That lovely violin work comes from Korean-born violinist Harim Elizabeth Lee. It's on her new album, My Time Is Now, Inspirations from the Gershwins. Lee has spent years training as a classical violinist, capped off by earning her doctorate at the University of Michigan, which is where she latched onto the music of the Gershwins to the point where the piano used on this recording is one that belonged to George Gershwin. She is here with us now. Liz, it is a pleasure to welcome you to Stateside.
Thank you so much. It's wonderful to be back in Ann Arbor.
I have to tell you, I listened to My Time Is Now as I drove, and it was the best antidote to stress and traffic. It is purely lovely. It's so lovely. And what struck me is the way that you've mixed a very respectful interpretation of Gershwin's music with your own spirit and your own interpretation. So Gershwin lovers are going to hear what they love, but they're going to hear something new. How hard was it to get that balance?
I think the hardest part is actually, you know, to take the story out of the musical notes, because actually these are all arrangements. So it actually allowed me to really dig deep into what the original intent was, which were songs, and many times were piano works. As George Gershwin unfortunately died at a very young age, he never was able to complete a full violin work. So I really tried to imagine, and in a way it freed me to be able to perform the way I want, because actually I need to play like a singer, for example.
Yes, so that's something that really does come across. Just thinking of, for example, An American in Paris. It was so sprightly and so wonderful and so true to what I've often heard, and yet done with this wonderful arrangement for your violin and this piano. And you were able to do that because of the access you had to Gershwin's material. So did you discover and latch on to Gershwin when you came to the University of Michigan?
Gershwin is a type of music that I've always loved. And I think when I came to Michigan and with the announcement of Gershwin Initiative, it just kind of hit home for me, because it kind of reminded me of that simple time when I didn't know what classical music was, when I didn't know any labels. And it just brings you back home to the reason why I do this thing, you know, why I play music. You're like, I just love this.
That makes you happy.
Exactly.
Well, it comes across in your work as you play your violin. And kind of remind us, we have talked about this on Stateside, but kind of give us a refresher in the deep relationship between Gershwin and the University of Michigan that resulted in this Gershwin Initiative.
So in 2013, there was a relationship and a collaboration really between the Gershwin family, where they allowed University of Michigan to really dig deep and do all the research and to make new additions for all the vast repertoire there is. As a part of the Gershwin Initiative, the Gershwin family gifted University of Michigan with one of George Gershwin's very own piano from his New York apartment. There's three, and I believe this is the only one that's really been restored to its original sound.
Oh, and what a sound it is. So we are talking about this 1933 Model A Steinway that your collaborator, pianist Alex Brown, plays so beautifully. And what was that like as you were recording, he's playing, and you're realizing that is the very piano that George Gershwin used? It was a part of his life. Was there some kind of a special sense of that as you were working?
Absolutely. I mean, from the first time I heard this piano in Hill Auditorium, it just hit me because we're so now used to hearing the huge powerhouse piano. But this is a Model A. It's slightly smaller, and the sonority, it just sounds like butter. And that's something I wanted to capture. And the way Alex played as a classically trained jazz musician, and that's really reflects Gershwin's spirit. And that's exactly why I wanted to use Alex. And you just feel the spirit. I mean, myself, the producer, Alex, we were just constantly in awe as the sounds were ringing afterwards. And then it would just be captured in the wonderful recording. And it's just incredible to hear that. It's really the third collaborator.
So this album, My Time Is Now, Inspiration from the Gershwins, it has some tracks that are very, very familiar tunes. And some that perhaps are not as widely known. Tell me about how you chose the material for this project.
So in part of my time in University of Michigan, I took a class with Dr. Clegg, who is in charge of the entire edition for the Gershwin repertoire.
Dr. Mark Clegg. Very familiar to stateside listeners, yes.
And in one of our readings, I came across a quote by George Gershwin, and it was, "My people are American, my time is today. Music must repeat the thought and the aspirations of the time." And just somehow it all kind of came together in, honestly, an instant moment. I knew this was my inspiration, and that's kind of the seed that now the flower has bloomed.
And you have this wonderful album. How did you go about rearranging this material that was, you know, written for piano into something to be done for violin and piano? So you've got these original scores, you've got the source material. So what did you and Alex do to make this something that is familiar yet new?
In a way, because they were already arrangements, we really felt that we had the freedom to arrange it in the way that we interpreted. And one of the main things was to highlight the piano. For example, we not only have George Gershwin's piano, we know he was a pianist who frequently improvised upon his own parts. So it only makes sense that we really take the time to dig deep ourselves into what we think could be highlighted in all of the different wonderful repertoire that we have.
Now, there are some pieces that are not Gershwin pieces on here. I'm thinking of one, it's actually track two, hashtag TBT. Tell me about the composer and about this piece and why you chose it.
Patrick Harlan is a classmate from University of Michigan. And as a part of this project, as Gershwin said, music should really reflect the time. I really wanted to take this opportunity to give a platform to the music of my time and what is current to me now. And I thought this was a wonderful opportunity to also commission a new work that really resonates with the time of today. And of course, hashtag TBT, Throwback Thursday, was rather appropriate. And in the piece, Patrick actually uses some Gershwin quotes in his own music. So it's really fun to listen to and for you to kind of be a detective to figure, oh, which quote is that from which work of Gershwin? Thank you.
and you've got to stop and you think George Gershwin, as this as his piano was being used, was probably listening with a smile, because he was the young guy who was pushing the paradigm and pushing the envelope in the 1930s and you know, the early 20th century. So I'm sure he was going, that's excellent, way to go. So were you going to tour and perform to support this album? Are you going to be out on the road?
Absolutely. I'll be out there, and I'll also be doing a tour in Korea, my home country as well, where, of course, they just adore the music of American music, really, and Gershwin, of course. And it's just amazing to hear music that's so significantly American resonate with the world.
Have you got any Michigan dates set?
I will be here in October 28th in Brinton Hall, with the piano, with the Gershwin piano.
Oh, that'll be wonderful. Harem Elizabeth Lee, her new album is My Time Is Now, Inspirations from the Gershwins. It is lovely, and thank you for sharing this with us.
Thank you so much for having me here.
Support for arts and culture coverage comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs.
Coming up, how did a reality TV show host become the leader of the free world? The new book, Audience of One, offers a theory.
He set out to court the cameras, to court the media, and create a persona, a character of himself that he then leveraged into other areas of accomplishment.
That's after the break here on Stateside. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. How did an NBC game show host become the leader of the free world, vaulting from the faux boardroom of The Apprentice into the Oval Office?
And you interrupt me.
If I stay, I
want
to stay
on
the
trip. And you were no great shakes yourself.
Summer,
you did a lousy job.
So sorry.
Here I am. I'm getting ready practically to fire this guy. And you keep interrupting me and stopping me from doing it. And in the end, what Carolyn said to you is true.
I want him to be fired.
She said, what have you done? And you couldn't answer it. You know what, Summer? You're fired.
A new book called Audience of One, Donald Trump, Television, and the Fracturing of America offers some answers to this question. It's written by James Poniewozik, who's chief television critic for The New York Times. Before that, he was the TV and media critic for Time Magazine. Before that, he grew up in Monroe and graduated from the University of Michigan. Welcome, James.
Well, welcome. Go Blue.
Go Blue. Okay, good to have you with us. So you state unequivocally, without TV, there is no Trump. And you also state Donald Trump is not a person. Why?
Donald Trump, for the purposes of my book, and I think relevant to the national interest at this point that he's president, the Donald Trump that concerns me is Donald Trump, the TV character, the TV performance. From the beginning of his career, long before politics, long even before The Apprentice, his primary goal in life has been celebrity, has been attention. He intuited very early on that media attention and media ubiquity in a heavily mediated culture was a very valuable commodity. And he set out to court the cameras, to court the media, and create a persona, a character of himself that he then leveraged into other areas of accomplishment.
And as we,
so, you know,
and as we could hear in that clip from The Apprentice, it's pretty much what we're seeing today in the news.
Exactly. You know, that voice of Donald Trump on The Apprentice was, you know, very much the voice of Donald Trump that you will hear, you know, at press podiums or speaking on the White House lawn, or, you know, you metaphorically hear it through Twitter, that sort of pugilistic, combative fighter performance, that fighter persona was something that he brought to The Apprentice and became a star through that, and learned that he was rewarded for it, and that these were sort of rewards and performances that translated very well to what politics has become in America.
And as I read Audience of One, you took us back to something that I'd kind of forgotten about. We're going to take a listen to this, back to 1980, nearly four decades ago, when a 33-year-old Donald Trump sat down on the Today Show with Tom Brokaw. And Brokaw asked Trump about New York real estate development, and particularly why he destroyed some vintage sculptures on an old building he bought.
We purchased a site with an old department store on it, the old Bonwit Teller store on 5th Avenue and 57th Street next to Tiffany, and we had to really take the building down. And there were many people that didn't want us to take it down. They wanted to try and preserve the building. But the building really was not worth, as an art building or an art deco building, it really was not worth very much. And we did take it down, and there was somewhat of an outcry, but I think that's generally subsided now, and I think people like what we're doing and like the building that we're putting in its place.
Interesting, we hear the many people. That was even back in 1980, but certainly a more measured Donald Trump. And then let's contrast that with over this past weekend, the Trump rally in Minneapolis.
And they're always saying the same thing. Yeah, he got $1.5 billion. We admit it, they admit it, there's nothing. But always that same thing. President Trump made a totally unsubstantiated claim about Hunter Biden and his father. It's not unsubstantiated, you crooked son of a guns. It's 100% true.
So where do we get from that 1980 Trump to this weekend's Trump?
So, you know, as you say, you can hear elements of the current Trump in that 1980 interview, but it's also a very different tone, much more sort of soothing, trying to tamp down conflict rather than escalate conflict. And in part, you know, you can attribute that to changes in the person over time, but also very much that you can attribute to a change in the media over time. That, in many ways, was the voice of mainstream media back in the mid-20th century when it was a three-network environment, when every show on TV had to draw much wider, bigger, broader audience, and everything and everybody on it had to appeal to more people. Part of what you got over the decades, as I chronicle in the book, as you had the development of cable, the internet, smaller and smaller niche audiences, is you have more and more polarizing programming, like reality TV, and more polarizing characters, both in entertainment and in politics. And Donald Trump, who always adapted himself to the media of his time, jumped into that with both feet and found that ultimately in this new environment, there were rewards for being the fighter guy, for antagonizing people, for polarizing people, for not necessarily being for everybody and for picking fights. And, you know, the things that he was rewarded for were the things that he emphasized and drew out in his personality. And, you know, that's partly how we got from here to there, and it's partly how he got from here to there.
Yeah, it is something to go through your book and kind of remember, and I will say I'm old enough to remember that in the 1960s we were watching, you know, Sheriff Andy of Mayberry and Pa Cartwright and his sons on Bonanza. And then by the early 2000s, you got Tony Soprano, you have Survivor's Richard Hatch, and you get Donald Trump firing people on The Apprentice. So we went to these anti-heroes. There was a place for them.
Exactly. That was another kind of archetype that could emerge and thrive in television in an era where you had sort of smaller niche programming environments. You know, obviously, television didn't invent the anti-hero. You know, that goes back to, you know, Dostoevsky and literature, and you know, certainly there have been anti-heroes in film and so on. But television, because it's a mass medium, worked on different principles when it was a mass three-network medium. Once you had your HBOs, your cable outlets, you had the development of reality TV, you developed this idea of learning to follow and root for characters who you maybe thought weren't admirable, maybe weren't moral, maybe weren't kind or decent, but they were entertaining. They were fighters. They put on a great show. You know, they might not have been good, but they were right, you know, be it, you know, Simon Cowell on American Idol,
yeah.
You know, or an anti-hero on an HBO show. And that was, you know, not necessarily something that Donald Trump consciously modeled himself on, but it was something in the atmosphere of the times that allowed a character like him in politics and in the media to thrive and develop a following.
And the reality show audiences that watch Survivor, watch The Apprentice, they know it's not true, but they don't care because it feels real.
It feels real. It's entertaining. In a way, there is, I think, you know, very much a consciousness among reality show viewers that, you know, they're savvy and they know that these things are edited and kind of fakey, and they pride themselves on knowing that. And one interesting thing I think that you can also map onto the political phenomenon of Donald Trump is that this allows you to encourage a kind of cynicism, you know, where you can kind of shade the boundaries between whether you're telling the truth or you're lying, whether you really mean something or whether you're joking, and cultivate an audience that says, well, everything's kind of fake. Everything's a show. So, you know, just enjoy the show and go along with my team and don't worry too much about the details.
Don't believe anything unless I tell you.
Exactly. I think that was a Trump quote, right?
It
what
was.
You're seeing and hearing in the news, that's not the truth.
Yes.
Yeah.
I'm speaking with New York Times TV critic James Poniewozik about his book, Audience of One, Donald Trump, Television and the Fracturing of America. Let's talk about your home state of Michigan. You use this in your book as an example of through the Trump campaign and exploring Trump's Make America Great Again messaging. What was it about that message and about Donald Trump that spoke to enough Michigan voters to help him win the White House?
One thing that, you know, that Make America Great Again is at heart, just culturally, is a nostalgia argument. You know, it's the argument, and you can read this on a cultural level, a religious level, a racial level, et cetera, that there was a time when things used to be better, and you got more respect, people were better off, whatever, and I'm going to bring you back to that time. You know, one thing that I think is sort of suffused in a lot of Michigan culture and Michigan popular culture, certainly it was something that I noticed, you know, growing up, even back in the 70s and 80s, is this notion of, you know, of nostalgia, of being told that there were better times before you came along, when the car auto plants were, you know, humming and producing jobs, and, you know, and the assembly lines were running. You know, there's a building, you know, in on the Detroit skyline called the Renaissance Center that, you know, since 1977, I think,
yeah,
has objectified the promise that things were once great and there will be a Renaissance someday. You know, and that's it's just such. Both in pop culture, as we can see in, you know, the reboot culture of Netflix and the movies nowadays, and in politics, nostalgia is a powerful, magnetic, and multi-purpose tool.
When Trump was being Trump on The Apprentice, and we read in your book ways where he would go off the rails, do something, and the editors would all have to run back and scramble and kind of re-engineer the show to fit what he had done. So he had producer Mark Burnett and that squad of editors crafting what went out on NBC on show night. But now he's in the White House. There's no more executive producer. The John Kellys and the General Mattises, McMasters, they've given up and they've resigned. And even though Donald Trump, as we see in your book, is very skilled at dominating TV, will he be able to control the media story that exploded about the time your book came out, which was the impeachment inquiry?
I think it's a lot more difficult for him because, you know, what he is very good at and is still good at is drawing attention to himself. And that's a tactic, but it's not necessarily a strategy. You know, it's a way of making things about you at all times, but you're not necessarily getting out a message that's beneficial to you. You know, as you say, when he was on The Apprentice, he could make mercurial decisions, you know, illogical decisions, and somebody would go back and edit things so that there seemed to be a logic to the final project. Now, you see that falls to his press secretaries and Mike Pence and the spokesmen who are drafted to go out onto Sunday morning shows and try to retrofit logic onto Trump's decisions in the Ukraine or in Syria or this or that. And one other, you know, if you just look at impeachment as a TV show, a media production, as so much politics is now, one thing where that presents a particular problem for him is it's a show where he's not necessarily the protagonist. He's the object, but not necessarily the subject. Other people are making actions. Other people are setting the terms of, you know, the plot and directing it. And as opposed to the 2016 campaign, where by drawing so much attention, he was able to make himself the protagonist of it, this is a TV show that he's a bit out of control of.
How do people who watch the Trump show as it's happening, as you say, we get this raw, unfiltered feed out of the Oval Office, for people who feel it's appalling and scary, what can they take from your book, Audience of One, to help kind of understand and look beyond?
You know, I think it's important to understand that politics and cultural arguments generally, you know, all the cultural arguments that we have today, they're in part stories. There are battles in the media. There are battles for attention. There are battles for television coverage. And you don't necessarily have to win those battles by simply being the most negative and antagonistic and so forth. There are other ways of doing that. But, you know, I think it's important to understand how it works and not to sort of just, you know, loftily set yourself above the tawdry business of competing in the media, but to understand that media, television, and, you know, adjuncts like social media and the internet, like those are the nervous system of our culture now, of our politics. And it's important to, you know, join the fight in them and use them to tell a better story, because otherwise you are conceding them for somebody to tell a worse story.
The book is Audience of One, Donald Trump, Television and the Fracturing of America. And James Poniewozik is coming back to his home state on Monday, October 21st at noon. He'll be at the Metro Detroit Book and Author Society event at Burton Manor in Livonia. And then later that evening, 7 p.m., he will be at the downtown branch of the Ann Arbor District Library. It is a fascinating look at America and look at the man in the Oval Office. James Poniewozik, thank you so much for being with us and for this great book.
Thank you so much for having me.
Robert Fanning is a professor of creative writing at Central Michigan University. He's the author of 6 poetry collections and the founder of the Wellspring Literary Series in Mount Pleasant, where he lives with his wife and their 2 children. Our reviewer, John Freeman, says Robert Fanning's latest collection, Severance, is a triumph of the poetic imagination.
Faced with a gruesome injury and the recent loss of a sibling to suicide, the poet turns grief into a main character. And it's that character with whom he keeps counsel during his search for what he calls new song, a low note to split that puppet wood. This quest for new song, for a way to vanquish grief through writing, comprises the dramatic tension of Severance. The book's setting is an imagined puppet theater called Winterland, wherein the 2 main characters in his allegory, Grief and Professor, perform. But the trauma experienced by Professor when he loses his brother and horrifically injures his arm makes the scripted performance impossible to keep up. "Time to leave the life of the stage," said Grief, Fanning writes in the poem titled I Came Blue. The lyricism Fanning invents in this book elevates him into that rarefied air typically reserved for writers like Wallace Stevens. Mimicking how his wrists once dangled, he laughs. "No strings attached, puppet. No cross, no hand. You're free." And so, unspindling light and day, he unspools me from the play. I had the benefit of hearing Fanning read from this collection at Green Brain Comics in Dearborn. It was a rare instance where the performance was equal to the poetry itself. He employs distinctly different voices for each character, even singing certain sections with a clear, mellifluous baritone. In other words, this is a fully imagined, fully dramatized bit of theater. One gets the sense, both from reading the book and hearing Fanning read from it, that the emotions are real, that the poet's feelings are our own. Fanning is a poet who pushes language to the brink of absurdity and loss, combining words to create wild neologisms, scrambling parts of speech to create beautiful music that captures trauma and loss with a haunting poignancy. In The Flute of Hours, Fanning presents us with a disturbing image of suicide. Brother swayed from the beam, from his black-gloved puppeteer. Later in the same poem, he writes, "Through all the play, grief, I studied the birds and fish. I saw the bolts and screws, but I wanted flesh, not fish or feather." Poems and songs cannot bring back those we've lost, but Fanning can't stop trying. He still has ghosts to sing away. Thank you.
Today's Stateside was directed by Mercedes Mejia. Our executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors today are Mike Blank, April Van Buren, Adam Reyes, Tad Davis, and Catherine Newham. Stateside's a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.